Hey everybody, welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave. We're here today to discuss the new Netflix series Wormwood, which is a combination documentary fictionalized account of the life and death of Frank Olson, and various implications about CIA involvement and potentially MK Ultra. I'm your host tonight. My name's Bina 007. We will obviously be spoiling the Netflix show. I'm joined also by Thomas.
Hi, this is Thomas FT Ward on the podcast Spice and Fireboards.
By Jock.
Hello, Jock. Mando Jock 2 on the forums.
Last and not least, we are joined by Varley.
Varley on the forums.
Nazi Germany, 1937!
I'm super glad I had mute on there.
Joseph Mengele officially joins the Nazi Party. He would later be at concentration camps, most notoriously Auschwitz, where he'd be conducting human experimentation without regard of his subjects. Due to his experimentation and consequent experiments such as the Tuskegee Syphilis experiment, the Stanford Prison experiment, and CIA's Project MK Ultra, the development of the Institutional Review Board gathers together for any human experimentation to okay its usage, conduct informed consent, and that way all participants know the potential dangers of the experimentation that is going to be taking place. This was developed in 1974, 1 year after the CIA officially closed down Project MK Ultra. 20 years before that was the death of what's his name? Olson. Sorry. God damn it. That was going really well, too. Which Wormwood takes over. And now I'll give it back to Bina.
Okie dokie. Right, so we're here today to discuss the show, but also really just get into some of the issues and conspiracies that underlie it. So maybe we should start off by going around the table and discussing your lemon cake rating for the series, and also what familiarity you had with the Frank Olson case before you started watching. Thomas, do you want to go first?
Sure. I guess for lemon cakes, or LSD laced cocktails or whatever we want to call them, I would give it something in the neighborhood of maybe like a 3.75. I
That's
did
incredibly
enjoy
precise.
it. Well, I didn't want to give it a 4, and I didn't think 3.5 was high enough. So I enjoyed it. I thought it was very good in parts. I just thought it was overlong. I didn't really feel like it needed to be 6 hours or however many hours it ended up being. I felt like it could have been told certainly in like 4 hours without any real issue. I enjoyed the dramatic parts, but I also thought that they were a little too indulgent, and I felt like they implied knowledge of things that I didn't feel like the show demonstrated that they had, like dialogue and stuff like that.
You mean you didn't like seeing Peter Sarsgaard just dance like a crazy person for no reason for 5 minutes?
I didn't hate it. I thought it
Or stand
was.
on his head.
I mean, my rating's exactly the same, actually. It's kind of 3.5. I think it's a compelling story. I really think it was far too long. It could easily, for me, have been a 2-hour normal Errol Morris
Yeah.
documentary. And in doing that, I think just getting. I mean, I love the actors and I think it's really well done. But like you say, I think there's a blurring of fact and fiction when you do that that I didn't particularly appreciate. So I think the fiction was well done, but I didn't need it. How about you, Jock? What would you give it?
Probably a 3 out of 5. Same sort of thing. Too long, and I wasn't too fond of the sort of split screen format that they did it in.
And Mr. Varley?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to make this like a big circle jerk, but yeah, 3.5, 3.75, something like that. It was good. It was, as stated, overly long. I did have some issues with it just in general. I don't understand how they can get a receive a settlement, be okay with it, and then years later, like bring it back up. Like, weren't they given hush money by the government to, you know, they got the White House Gerald Ford visit and everything else, and now they just want to, you know, dig it back up for publicity or for, you know, whatever reasons. I felt it kind of disingenuous, and then that also goes to what you were saying about like the dramatized portions were very well done, but it's presuming a lot, I feel like, at times. But overall, I liked it.
And how far did any of you know about the Frank Olson case before? Because I have to admit, I'd never heard of it. So I knew about MKUltra more generally, but I really didn't know about him. So I watched it on the strength of knowing and admiring Errol Morris's documentaries rather than the subject matter.
History Channel did a big thing on like LSD and like the hippie culture and kind of, you know, how it developed out of these government experiments and stuff like that. So I knew about Frank Olson for a while, but he was always like the CIA guy that, you know, was tripping balls and, you know, air quotes, fell out of a window.
Yeah, I guess the same. I was aware kind of the, whatever we want to call it, the CIA cover story from the 70s. And I assumed that that was heinous enough and accurate that they had done kind of unwitting experiments on human subjects, and that he had a bad trip and it resulted in his death. And I guess we'll get into what this documentary actually says that they likely believe happened. But I was aware of that story for a long time. I mean, just kind of reading about the CIA and, again, passingly about MKUltra and documentaries and reading, but I've never gone in depth on either of those. So.
And have you guys watched Errol Morris documentaries before?
I'm not aware if I have or not.
I've seen, I've seen The Thin Blue Line for sure. I've never watched his McNamara or his Rumsfeld one. I think I would be interested in both of those, but I've never watched. I want to say he's directed just dramatic movies too, or no?
I can check this up on IMDb Pro. I think he's definitely a documentarian. I've seen all his documentaries, and what was intriguing to me is that I really love him for the work he did on Robert McNamara. I think that was amazing.
So does he focus in on this kind of like mid-century American like government, or what may I have seen of his?
I mean, he's done various stuff, right? It's sort of, but yeah, he does. I mean, he was the exec producer on The Act of Killing, which is one on, you know, I mean, I think he's very interested in political subjects and the concept of, you know, power being abused and secrets being uncovered. What he's really famous for technically is he developed a way of putting his face on the lens of the person he was interviewing so that they were almost looking at him as they were talking to the camera. And he's kind of quite obsessed with the idea of stripping away, having, you know, some documentarians are really sort of present in the film. He doesn't want to be present in the film, but he wants to have the person speaking to you intimately. And I think it's really interesting that when you look at Wormwood, he like throws all that out the window.
Yeah, he is present. It's interesting.
He's very present. He did do another one, a documentary called Tabloid, which is really hilarious about this, the Manacled Mormon. I don't know if you've ever heard of that case, which is really funny. But anyway, I strongly encourage you to check that out.
Huh.
So, just so you've seen everything he's done, I know in the Thin Blue Line, which was a documentary about a shooting of a police officer in Dallas, I think in the 70s, there is some dramatic stuff in there, like some like actors portraying the scenes of what happened or what various people say happened, but I don't think there's any dialogue.
No,
really.
It's just more sort of impressionistic, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Kind of like a Rashomon, kind of the different people, their versions, and each plays out kind of dramatically. But I don't, and like I said, I've only seen one or two of his movies before, so I don't know how common this.
I mean, maybe he feels that because he got the extra time of the Netflix series that he had the space to do the fictionalized stuff. And also, I guess with the money they were giving him, had the money to get actors of that caliber. But yeah, I don't think it was massively necessary. Although it features the actress who was in Mindhunter, no?
Molly Parker, right?
Yeah.
I really love her.
Exactly. Very good.
Yeah, I thought it was really good at setting up the kind of context and things, but it was just too much. And again, I felt like it just presumed too much that it didn't prove that we knew.
I agree. Okay, so the story that we're told is one of Frank Olson, who's an American scientist born in 1910, but this is really focusing on sort of post-World War II. He specializes in bacteriology and basically, I think, is an expert in creating delivery devices for weaponized anthrax and ends up working for, well, do we know, let's start off with what we know. We don't know if he directly worked for the CIA, but he was employed at Camp Detrick in Maryland.
Yeah, I've watched another documentary where it explicitly says that he was a CIA agent. I don't know whether he's a civilian doctor for the military, or he's in the chemical corps, or he's working for the CIA directly, whether it's a difference without distinction, but he's in it.
Yeah, there's this weird like kind of Venn diagram of like, you know, the Defense Department and the CIA, and like where they overlapped, and kind of there's this nebulous, you know, where he probably was working for a private company technically, but, you know, doing research for the Army and or for the Department of Defense and CIA.
Right.
So, it's all military industrial intelligence complex, and they're all incestuously in it together, I think.
What I say during JFK, man.
So at some point, this is now supposition. We assume that he got cold feet about the nature of the work that he was doing. And there is one story out there that he had entry and exit stamps in his passport, suggesting he'd been to Sweden, Germany, and Britain in the summer of 1953, which is just before he died. And that he told a British psychiatrist called Sargent that he'd visited secret joint American-British testing and research installations near Frankfurt. British journalist Gordon Thomas's hypothesis is that the CIA was testing interrogation and truth serums there, not on monkeys, but on human subjects, captured Russian agents and ex-Nazis. And Thomas says that Olson confessed to Sargent that he'd witnessed something terrible, possibly a quote-unquote terminal experiment, and that this was sort of a summer where he was really doubting what he was mixed up in. Sargent heard Olson out and then reported him to the British intelligence services, and he was deemed to be a security risk and denied further access to Porton Down, which is the British Chemical Weapons Research Establishment. So how far do you guys believe he was having a crisis of confidence? Because the documentary makes a lot of him seeing a film starring a film about Martin Luther and, you know, having a crisis of conscience and wanting to.
Yeah. I don't know. Thomas, do you have a articulate answer?
No, I mean, I don't. But I think what Bina says, what I've read and seen as well, that it was on this trip, and I think he was working for the CIA on this trip and going to CIA facilities, and he is really a security risk. I mean, it's not the first time we're going to have a doctor kind of violating their client's relationship, but he is a security risk at a certain level at this point.
Well, I mean, the whole point of MK Ultra was because we thought the Russians and the communists had mind control, because, you know, they mind controlled like our pilots that were captured in Korea to tell them to admit to using germ warfare. So the whole point of MK Ultra was to get this, like, you know, air quote brainwashing mind control kind of agent to work. And there were, the CIA specifically was very paranoid that they already had a mole, a Russian mole in their like highest ranks. So someone as low down as Frank Olson, which I guess he wasn't that low down, right? Because he was chief of this program.
I think he was very expert in his niche area of weaponizing anthrax.
Yeah. So, you know, with his own project, I believe he was the leader, you know, co-leader with Gottlieb.
Well, I think Gottlieb was in charge, and he had, I think Olson had resigned his leadership to that Vin Rouette character at some point in the year or two beforehand. But he was, I think Olson was in charge of this group at Fort Detrick at some point, though not in the last week or so of his life.
Do you guys believe it's true that the former allies were conducting Mengele-type experiments on prisoners of war after the war?
Well, with the Operation Paperclip, it's documented that we saved Nazi scientists that had done these experiments and worked alongside them to extend them.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt we were using their research at concentration camps that the Nazis had done, and I put nothing past us that we were operating on live people at this point, if not in the continental United States, I think in around the world we were, for sure.
Well, I mean, especially with the MK Ultra, they would be given these hallucinogenics to like prisoners in exchange for heroin. So they'd use like their addictions to like be like, oh, we can give you another like little hit if you want to do this experiment. So it's completely unethical. There were people that did sign up to participate in this, and you know, was a manhunter, kind of brought this up. Maybe Ted Kaczynski unwittingly took a part of MKUltra experiments. Yeah. But Kesey, members of the Grateful Dead, because they're just willfully taking acid to trip out. You know, so Kesey obviously went on to write One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, The Grateful Dead, and fuck, I'm forgetting one other big one. Anyway, so, I mean, there were willful participants, but there were also unwilling, unknowing.
There were non-willful ones as well, and from another author, there was Ian Fleming at a spy camp in Canada. They spiked him there.
Yeah, so maybe that brings us on to the next section of the story is he has doubts, he becomes a security risk. So what do we know? On November the 19th, 1953, there was a meeting between the CIA and Fort Detrick scientists at Deer Creek Lodge in rural Maryland, and Sidney Gottlieb of the CIA slipped LSD into Olson's glass of Cointreau. After 20 minutes, he develops mild symptoms of disorientation. He was then told his drink had been spiked.
But it wasn't only his drink, right? They did it to, like, half the party.
Oh, really? Okay.
I believe that's correct, yeah.
So was it just for larks, then?
So it was basically... They used all sorts of experimentation. Like, they put two people in a room, tripping balls together, asking each other questions, and then writing down the response. Like, they just wanted to see how interactions would work on this drug. So this was, like... Like you said, they dosed them, and then they told them they were dosed, but only after like consumption. So they just wanted to see how to interrogate someone to see if they would give up secrets, basically. And this was like almost a common thing.
Yeah, I've read that too. That they would just do this like to your coffee at work and stuff like that too.
So they weren't actually trying to precipitate a nervous breakdown. That was an independent thing that occurred.
Well, no, that happened. Actually, there's a couple stories. I think one was like in the mid-50s, like a CIA agent running naked down the streets of Washington, D.C. because he was tripping balls.
Okay. The next day, Olson returned home and spent the weekend in a mood that his wife, Alice, remembers of as withdrawn but not remotely psychotic. He kept saying he had made a terrible mistake, but she couldn't get him to say what. On the Sunday night, they go to see the film Martin Luther, which the documentary Wormwood makes out to be the big crisis of conscience moment. The next day, Olson goes straight to his boss Ruitt's office and says he wants to resign. Ruitt told him to calm down. The next morning, he returns to the office and insists that his resignation be accepted. And Alice's memory is of Frank being in the grip of an ethical dilemma. Someone has said, quote, he appeared to be greatly agitated and in his own words all mixed up. So do you want to discuss that before we move on to New York?
No, I would just, no, I don't think so.
Okay.
I was just going to say something about like the collage method that Eric Olson is into and how that kind of plays into how, at least the way I took it, how Morris kind of directs the movie with these kind of mixed images of film and interview and still photos and home films and all that kind of stuff. But
yeah, absolutely, that's a great metaphor.
Okay, so I didn't find the streaking story, but here's a good one. According to Senate testimony, Project Midnight Climax ran in San Francisco brothels where patrons were doused with LSD.
Yeah, they had hidden rooms behind the other place in the back of it. And it's quite interesting because I think one of the times they had to leave because they didn't factor in toilet breaks or anything.
Yeah, they had two-way mirrors that they had observed people on LSD and their interactions.
It's your tax dollars at work.
Oh, dear. Okay, so after...
They also gave a lot of it to the mob as well.
Yeah, and to, you know, bring it back around, Gerald Ford shut it down, but his two staff leaders were Rumsfeld and Cheney. But they didn't actually prosecute anyone for the CIA's mishandling of Americans.
Indeed. Okay, so he hands in his resignation, and then this is where it gets a bit shady. Well, if it weren't already. Ruitt and Robert Lashbrook, a CIA liaison at Fort Detrick, take Olsen to New York, apparently to seek psychiatric advice. The doctor that Olsen sees is an allergist named Harold Abramson, who was receiving CIA financing to experiment with LSD as well. And apparently he prescribed Olsen Nembutal and bourbon to help him sleep. I didn't realize that was available on prescription.
That's the 50s. That's what they did.
God bless 1950s America. Olsen was then taken to see John Mulholland, a New York magician on the CIA payroll, who may have tried to hypnotize him. So the whole thing just is crazy. Ruitt told CIA investigators that in Mulholland's presence, Olsen became highly agitated. He kept asking, "What's behind this? Give me the lowdown. What are they trying to do to me? Are they checking me for security?" So highly paranoid. According to documents Colby then gave the family after the Gerald Ford meeting, Olsen then spent an agonized night wandering the streets of New York, discarding his wallet and identification cards. He said he was too ashamed to go home to his wife and children, so he and Lashbrook ate a Thanksgiving dinner at an automat in Midtown and then go back. Late that day, according to the CIA, it was decided that Olsen needed to be institutionalized. Yet when he phones his wife that night, he said he was much better and would see her the next day. And that night, in room 1018A, with Lashbrook in the bed by the door, Olsen was calm. He washes out his socks and underwear and goes to sleep. 4 hours later, Armand Pastore finds him lying on his back on 7th Avenue. So what do you all make of the various doctors and magicians, apparently, that he was taken to see? What is the CIA trying to do at this point?
Anything and everything. I mean, this is like the Men That Stare at Goats kind of era CIA, where they're just throwing anything against the wall and seeing what sticks.
But is their idea at this point to try and get him to drop his knee to resign? I mean, are they actually trying to get him back on the program, or do you think they've already decided that they need to get rid of him and they just need to incriminate him as being crazy?
Yeah, I think they're trying to discredit him and trying to get him to say or do things that would allow them to do that. And I think he is rightfully paranoid.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe like to probe vulnerabilities to like, can he keep this a secret? You know, like, is he fine just walking off this project and shutting his mouth, or will he, you know... Does he show like a need to shine light on what he perceives as wrong with this?
Okay, so the poor guy is dead on the pavement. The police come in. The original police report basically assumes that it is suicide, that he purposefully threw himself out of the window of the hotel.
So it's through the window too, not just out of the window, but through actually the window. Through the closed window.
That's important.
But doesn't the show like make it sound like he opens the window?
I think I mean, again, it's the kind of thing where he films this scene like multiple times, but I don't recall them. It's possible they did, but I don't recall that.
Yeah, because like they're watching the fight, and then like it's the
Lashbrook.
Yeah, at one point the show portrays him like in the middle of the night, like smoking a cigarette on the shitter, and then like hearing a couple sounds, and then that's him going out the window, which would imply that he wasn't a part of it, or that
he wasn't a direct part of the actual murder, but he just went in the other room, opened the door, let the people in.
Yeah, I did really like the first episode of the series when. He, you know, you could tell like he's tripping out Skarsgård, Frank Olsen, and he walks by his room and walks down the hall only to end up back at his room. And like, you know, it was very like a psychedelic, you know, disorientating kind of series. I thought that was very cool.
Yeah, I think I don't know. So there's a lot of stuff in this series about the nature of the hotel room, about his son then trying to visit or mustering up the sort of the fortitude to go and visit it, and apparently immediately realizing that there's no way someone could run at the window from the distance within the room, apparently. So the original autopsy, the 1953 medical report done, say that there are cuts and abrasions on the body, and that's what sparks the theories that he was assassinated by the CIA. And there is a CIA report at the time, which basically says there's an official story that it was an LSD-triggered suicide, but that this is completely inconsistent with the facts of the case, and they recommend disciplinary action against Gottlieb and Nashbrook, but Alan Dulles gives them only a mild reprimand. So basically, that's case closed at that point, right?
Yeah, so this is all internal, right? This is, when you say this is disclosed, this is not publicly disclosed. The only thing that's disclosed is that this guy committed suicide. None of the CIA involvement or the LSD involvement in 1953 is public yet.
Yeah, and crucially, the family do not have a clue. So you now have 22 years in which his wife becomes an alcoholic, in which his son, Eric, goes to Harvard, becomes a psychiatrist, but basically there's no knowledge of what happened. They just assume it was a suicide. They don't even truly know what his job was. And then that all changes in 1975 with the Rockefeller Commission report. Does anyone know much about this in the context of it? Because I hadn't heard of this beforehand, really. Does anyone want to chat about it?
You want to do this, Thomas?
No, I mean, you're welcome to if you have a better... The Rockefeller Commission, I forget... I think there's like a heart, there's like a Senate committee beforehand that kind of leads the Rockefeller Commission into CIA misdeeds in the early 70s. I'm really tempted to go up to, I work in the same law firm as Walter Mondale. I'm really tempted to just go up to his office, see if he's interested in talking about any of this one day, but I think I'd get in trouble if I did that. But
oh my God, you have to.
Yeah. But so the Rockefeller Commission, post-Watergate, right? Yeah, obviously post-Watergate.
It was really brought on by Watergate and this distrust in the government and abuses of power.
Series of the Church Commission and the Rockefeller Commission, and I think there's one more. And in the course of that, they discover some of the details of the Olson case and that they are made public. I don't think the family just reads about it in the newspaper, right? They're not even...
Yeah, New York Times, wasn't it?
Well, it's both the Times and the Wash Post are getting leaks on what's in the report. So June 11th, 1975, the Washington Post reveals that Rockefeller has discovered that, quote-unquote, a civilian employee of the Department of the Army unwittingly took LSD as part of a CIA test and developed serious side effects, then goes to New York, jumps from windows, and dies. And he's not named, but obviously the family can figure out who that is. And Ruitt basically confirms to the family that it is definitely Frank Olson, that he'd known the details in the story all along, and that, you know, that's when the family start getting kind of angry and agitating. There's also a New York Times leak in July 1975 where they say that Sidney Gottlieb is the person who was in charge of that experimentation program and that he was personally involved in the experiment that killed Frank Olson and then destroyed the program's records in 1973. So at that point, the family calls a press conference, gives Seymour Hersh an interview and announce that they're going to have a wrongful death lawsuit. And that's what triggers then Gerald Ford meeting them and certain bits of information being given to them.
Yeah.
So what, they weren't told as part of the Rockefeller Commission, that no one had the courtesy of doing that. This is just because of newspaper leaks, is my impression, or the impression given to me by the documentary.
And what's fucking insane is that Helms, the leader of the CIA at the time, destroyed most, like there's like, what, 20,000 remaining documents that weren't destroyed. And like some of the shit that they were like, oh, we don't need to get rid of this is... you know, Frank Olson's story, like what the fuck did they destroy? Like what was like more, you know, confidential than this?
My understanding was that this stuff was found only because it was kept in financial records that weren't destroyed, that like the actual case files and stuff were destroyed, but that there were connective financial records that had to do with this that they were able to piece together. But yeah, the CIA, I think it, the family jewels or whatever, they put together all their worst stuff and destroyed a lot of this again when Richard Helms was Central Intelligence Agency director.
Yeah, and especially for MK Ultra, a lot of CIA resources were, I mean, like the equivalent to like $500,000 a year was given just to McGill University to this one psychologist under like a phantom foundation name. So he never knew that he was getting money from the CIA. He thought he was getting it from like the Society for like Hematology and something and Human Ecology, I think it was called. And so like that was just one university, and there's 40 universities, like half a dozen prisons, a bunch of hospitals related with the universities and stuff like that, that were all a part of this kind of research that they were doing. So, I mean, it when Thomas, when you say, you know, like the financial trail, like there's a lot of transactions on an annual basis for this, what, 20 plus year project.
Yeah.
Just awful. Okay, so
yeah, it's hideous. I mean, it's absolutely hideous because these are doctors, obviously, and people, unwitting, innocent people, just had their lives utterly destroyed through this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's what came to me from Wormwood, or the tragedy of it is, it's not just Frank Olson, it's his wife who became an alcoholic but then did thankfully recover, but his son is very open and is really the driving personality in the documentary, and at the end he says, what would happen if someone tomorrow handed me a set of papers that definitively proved the CIA killed my dad? Would I feel better? No. You know, he admits he's gone down the rabbit hole on it. He admits it's sort of taken over his life. And, you know, the collateral damage is enormous here.
Well, I mean, he says it in the documentary, too. Until, like, they exhume his body, his father disappeared. Because, you know, there was a closed casket. Like, that could have been filled with flower sacks. Like, they don't, you know, they never saw the body.
Yeah, let's get to that. So effectively, immediately after the interview in 1975, the entire family receives the apology from President Gerald Ford in the Oval Office and the CIA Director William Colby. So Colby gives them a set of documents, so they kind of almost feel that they've had finally the truth, although obviously those documents were highly selective. What Colby doesn't tell them either is that Frank Olson was not a civilian employee of the Department of the Army. He was a CIA employee working at Fort Detrick. He reveals that in his autobiography 3 years later. So this is the interesting bit, Matt, for you, because I think you feel strongly about this. They drop the lawsuit against the CIA over the wrongful death plea. The government offers them an out-of-court settlement of $1.25 million, which is later reduced to $750,000, which they accept. But in accepting it, they give away their right to further civil or criminal proceedings against the government. What is interesting to me about this is, of course, you could argue, Matt, that they don't have the right to then bring this up again. But do you also have a right to say that when they made that agreement based on these partial documents by Colby, they thought they were acting in good faith, but they weren't because the government was still lying to them? I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Just, you know, due to recent news events, I'm becoming more wary of what is publicity seeking, and when someone accepts a payoff to be silent, what are the ethics behind taking that payoff? Like, can you go then, like, accept hush money, and then when it's acceptable, or you know, kind of a la mode, like in the fashion of right now when everyone else is coming out to say this against whoever, like, can your voice be heard as well, even though you took this money to be silent?
It's a very slippery one, isn't it? Because technically, legally, you shouldn't be able to say anything. You've taken the money. I guess what some people would argue is that, particularly in the Me Too cases, that the way in which those confidentiality clauses were imposed, that all the kind of institutional power was with the law firms of the offenders. So therefore, there's this kind of ethical reason why they shouldn't be bound by this sort of, that almost like that was a further symptom and weapon of the harassment and abuse.
But I mean,
I don't think that's necessarily the case here.
But isn't this abuse by the government? I mean, you don't have a Harvey Weinstein, you know, might behind it. It's the federal government. It's the CIA that, you know, the
intelligence infrastructure. Well, who's more powerful than that? Who's more institutionally powerful than the federal government?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you're in the Oval Office with the President of the United States, and you're being lied to. I mean, whether Ford wittingly or unwittingly is doing that, I don't think this is hush money. I mean, they might have signed something that they're not going to sue, but I think they were lied to for 22 years, and then they were lied to again by the President of the United States in the Oval Office.
And then 40 years later, they decided.
And it's a murder. I don't want to make any kind of equivalencies between kind of sexual assault or sexual harassment or rape or murder, but their father was murdered. I don't think that they're... I never got the impression, and you guys might have a different one, that these people were in it for the money or anything.
No, and I think Eric Olsen is just...
Yeah, he's a compelling...
You know, he's a very well-respected, intelligent, you know, establishment figure himself, and I think he's the first to admit that he's not doing this for publicity or any kind of, like, well, I suppose it is a bit of a crusade, but it's to somehow quench that need within him for answers and for justice. You know, his father was taken away from him, and there's a visceral anger about that. But I think if he could switch it off, if he could turn it off, forget about it, and just live a normal, happy life, he would. My impression in the final kind of interview with him in the final episode of this documentary is he recognizes that this journey has brought him nothing but grief, and he wishes he could have somehow gotten over it and never will. And that's what makes it profoundly tragic.
Yeah.
He says at one point, like, if you could imagine the worst possible truth and then just assume that's what happened and lock that away and just walk away, he'd have been better off finding out that it was even worse than he imagined. And now that he has this knowledge, he can't, it's just going to consume him. It's just this trauma that he's never going to be able to get away from. And like Bina says, it's clearly, I don't want to say ruined his life, but it's changed his life, altered his life in a way that's not healthy, I don't think.
I mean, as Bina said, he's successful, so it obviously didn't ruin his life. Did it change his life? Did he grow up without a dad? Yeah, you know?
But I think he's been depressed. I mean, like I said, I find him a really compelling character, and I wish the documentary was shorter and was more just him, because he's really... This is just very poignant to me. Anyway.
Yeah, and he's extremely thoughtful. Like, a number of times during the documentary, he says, like, I don't like that language to describe, like, my father jumped. No, I don't think he jumped. I don't like that language, or, like, committed suicide. He's very thoughtful about this entire episode, because obviously it's as personal as you can get, right? But at the same time, I'm just wondering, like, why was now the time for, like, to broadcast this and to make this into a Netflix thing?
Oh, I think it's just now we're at peak TV and there's, like, a whole bunch of money available. I mean, if you look at Netflix, almost a couple of weeks after this was out, they brought out Dirty Money, which is a series of very well-financed, beautifully made investigative documentaries. So I think that the timing says far more about where TV is right now than it does about Eric Olsen.
So they're just looking for compelling stories and
absolutely
throw money at it and hire Skarsgårds.
There's nothing particularly new in the timeline of the story.
I put a link in the show notes to a YouTube documentary which basically covers everything in the documentary and in the Errol Morris series. And again, I was not aware of all this stuff, so it was new to me, but I don't actually think these disclosures and what Eric Olsen has found is new to him in any way.
Yeah, certainly, it's neatly, nicely packaged, basically. Yeah. Okay, so moving on from the government settlement in 1975. So at that point, once again, I think the family probably think it's case closed. They've had some information. But anyway, it doesn't rest well with Eric Olsen. In 1994, after the death of his mother, Alice, he decides to have his father's body exhumed and buried next to his mother. And given that the body's going to be exhumed, they decide to have a second autopsy performed. And it's performed by James Stars, Professor of Law and Forensic Science at the George Washington University National Law Center. And the team searches the bodies for cuts and abrasions, as in the original autopsy report. They don't find any. What Stars does find is a large hematoma on the left side of Olsen's head and a large injury on his chest, which most but not all of the team conclude is consistent with blunt force trauma to the head. And the injury to the chest had not occurred during the fall, but most likely in the room before the fall. One team member dissents, however, and, you know, says that he doesn't think there's anything untoward here. But Stars calls the evidence, quote-unquote, rankly and starkly suggestive of homicide. So this is kind of like the only real forensic evidence we get. What did you make of how it was both presented in Wormwood and what you think of it, regardless?
Can I just bring up something that the documentary regarding Olsen's mother? Did anyone else feel like they were hinting that she may have been having an affair with one of his coworkers?
Yes. I mean, yes. The way the shots were framed with her and Vin Rouette when they're, like, drinking, you get the impression that he's at least hitting on her and she is... so I don't know if they had an affair, or if, there's certainly a sexual tension presented in the dramatic part anywhere. I don't know any other facts.
Yeah, and I'm thinking with that, does that point to a different motive for the killing rather than just, you know, Frank Olson maybe willing to spill state secrets?
I think this was an institutional thing. I don't think this was personal. I mean, there might have been, he might have been happy in some level that to have Frank removed, but I think this is an institutional murder. Some of that dramatic stuff, I don't know what to make of that, I guess. Is that based in reality, or am I reading too much into it? Obviously, Matt saw kind of the same thing I saw, so... But I just don't know what the facts are of some of the dramatic presentation.
I agree, and I just didn't see the point in raising it. I don't know.
Well, I thought it was interesting that they would even hint at it, right? There must have been something...
And all distasteful, but yeah.
But there must have been something that Olson... Because he even says it when they're interviewing him, like... She would spend long amounts of time like drinking with him in like the kitchen or something, like, or in the other room or something like that. And that's why I was like, wait a minute, what is this relationship? And the fact that she immediately descends into alcoholism, you know, I mean, obviously losing her husband is crazy traumatic, but.
Yeah, I mean, she might just be lonely and
yeah.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I just don't know what to think about it, how as presented, so. But it is strange.
Yeah, and
I don't think it's ever fully addressed in the documentary either.
But isn't that like such like a? It's presented very deliberate, but isn't that such a flippant thing just to like put out there as a possibility? Like I thought. For
yeah,
the
I don't
most
know if
part,
it's to show Vin Rouette is a nefarious character or what.
Oh, maybe.
I don't know.
I just felt it was weird to bring it up, but then not fully explore it. Just a hint at it in some sort of titillating manner. I just didn't like that aspect of it, and I think that's the weakness of this series, isn't it? It's the fictional parts, because yeah, you can hint so much visually without, you can hint at so much just with who you put in a frame that you're not actually exploring with any facts or interviews afterwards.
And they showed even before Frank is dead, I remember a scene where Frank is coming in from outside or something, and Rouette and Molly Parker's character, I don't know her name, I forget her name, are in the kitchen, kind of, and just how their bodies are framed, and it appears to be a man and a woman flirting, just from their body language and stuff, the acting.
Yeah, and then even Skarsgård's reaction to him being there is almost like complacent, like he understands what's going on, like, and kind of accepts it in a way. I don't know. Was I reading that wrong?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so after the exhumation, then you have something that's not really to do with Olsen, but is very provocative for Erik Olsen. In 1997, the CIA declassified some documents and apparently inadvertently declassified an assassination manual dating from late 1953. Quote, "The most efficient accident in simple assassination is a fall of 75 feet or more onto a hard surface. Elevator shafts, stairwells, unscreened windows and bridges will serve. The act may be executed by sudden vigorous of the excised of the ankles, tipping the subject over the edge," end quote. The manual went on to recommend a blow to the temple to stun the subject first. Quote, "In cases it will usually be necessary to stun or drug the subject before dropping him." So yeah, apparently the CIA, someone's not got me on mute because I can hear myself. So apparently the CIA had a very tried and tested way of getting rid of people and making it look like suicide by means of blunt force trauma and then a push out of a window. But it's still all circumstantial, right?
Isn't that insane, though? Can't they just, like, the thought that they're not just going out there like the mob and being like, okay, two to the back of the head, that's good. You know, they're like, oh, this is how you make it look like an accident because we can't actually just kill someone. I don't know. I think it's just insane.
That's deeply sinister. The fact that this is all written down almost bureaucratically in a memo, it's
right, like,
quite horrific.
There has to be an expert, right? Like, there has to be some kind of, you know, white paper on it, right? Like, oh, in this instance, I found that, you know, the cops thought it was contrived and, you know, were hinting at, like, there was a murderer, but when I did it this way, the cops were like, hey, you tripped and fell and, you know, it was fine.
Yeah, I'm pretty certain the CIA could just tell the New York police what they wanted to tell them and that would be the end of it. That this, you know, just say this is national security or something, and that I doubt this was investigated thoroughly.
Yeah, there would still have been enough deference to them at that period, wouldn't there?
Yeah, well before
all the cynicism and disbelief in institutions that we have now.
Yeah, that and like a couple bucks with whatever story you wanted. But what I think this series also paints is like this absurd like feeling of patriotism, like this was okay because we're doing this for our country and like, you know, we're going to beat the Russians and that's what justified like doing all this experimentation on unknowing people. Like everything's a cool, like it's just, you know, I think at one point they're like, one of the guys was like, we felt we were patriots. We had to do this. We had to.
Yeah. It gets to that William Colby honorable men kind of quote, or, you know, that's how they viewed themselves. And whether,
I mean, arguably you could still view them that way, right? You could say that he was a threat to national security. I don't know.
But then anyone with any information was a threat, you know?
Well, anyone with doubts, and the doubts that he had, I think. I mean, there's no way out, is there? Do you guys give any credence to the idea that there was mob involvement in, what was it, this H.P. Alborelli, a writer-researcher with contacts amongst retired agents in Florida, said that they knew that it was part of the Trafficante mob. The CIA hired two people to come into the room and push him out. I just don't understand why it wouldn't just have been the CIA. Like, why do you necessarily need the mob to do that? If the mob has kind of, like, written up protocols on how to do it, just get on with it and do it. But
I think that's kind of like, you know, a usage contract that they had with the mob that was ongoing. Like, why would they risk one of their people when, you know, they can look the other way, the mob can make money here, and every now and then the mob, you know, needs to shut someone up for the CIA, and that happens. And also, I remembered who besides Kesey and the Grateful Dead did LSD? Whitey Bulger, who is a mobster in Boston, who Black Mass was based on.
He was also working with the government, it turned out.
Oh my God, he was a huge snitch. Well, you can have a head of the mob of Boston and his brother's head of the fucking FBI in Boston and wonder how he could have gotten away with anything. Ugh.
Yeah, no one thought this was a conflict of interest. Amazing. What about you, Thomas? Do you think the mob was involved?
Well, I think it's certainly plausible. I mean, I think at this point, anyone who doesn't think that the CIA was deeply involved with organized crime at this time and later is naive. I certainly think it's plausible that they contracted out the actual wet work, quote unquote, to...
But why? Why not just have Lashbrook do it? He's in the room.
Well, I think Lashbrook is just a, you know...
That's not his job. Yeah, he's not a hitman.
He's not a murderer. I mean, he's... He'll unlock the door and go in the other room.
So then it's your hypothesis that Lashbrook just looked the other way?
I think he had to.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know if looked the other way is the right way to put it. That he just removed himself and let it happen, or knew it was going to happen, set it up. He facilitated the whole thing. But I don't think he was...
Do you think he was in the room when it happened?
I think he was in the bathroom. That's when they come up, he's in the bathroom. That makes sense to me. That he just, at 2:30 or whatever time, he's supposed to unlock the door.
And that's, like, the plausible deniability. Like, I wasn't in the room. I didn't see who came in. I didn't see exactly what happened. I don't know if anyone actually did come in. You know, I was in the other room taking a dump and smoking a cigarette.
You can just say he heard the window break, and when he came out, Frank was on the pavement. And
the end
of that. Yeah. Gosh. So that's so far, that's 1997. And then finally, in Wormwood, I suppose the only thing that's genuinely new, and Thomas, we've had a bit of chat about this on the forums at a podcast of Ice and Fire, you have the journalist Seymour Hersh, who originally broke the Washington Post story, I believe, and leaked the Rockefeller documents, is interviewed in the Netflix series, and he says that the government had a security process to identify and execute domestic dissidents, aka, you know, perceived to pose a security risk, so that category that Frank Olson would have fallen into. He says, however, that he cannot elaborate or publish the facts because it would compromise his source. So, I mean, I don't find his allegation outlandish, because I think that is what happened. But I just do very much wonder at the kind of person who sees someone like Erik Olsen, whose entire life has been traumatized by this event, and dangles this carrot of knowledge, but says, oh, can't tell you though, because I'm protecting my source.
Well, this is a book deal, right? Like, his source, anyone involved, like, at this kind of level back then is, like, next step heaven, right? Or hell, whatever they did. So they're just waiting for his source to die, right? Because...
Do you think that's what it is? It's like Deep Throat. They just have to wait.
Yeah, I'm very cynical, and you know, just think that he's sitting on a book that will come out after his source has died. So you can.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Seymour Hersh is pretty old himself. I don't know what he's waiting for. I mean, I believe this kind of thing was not an isolated incident, and I kind of believe that Hersh is right that there was a mechanism in place to remove people that needed to be removed, and Hersh comes off, I think, not well. And you know, he's kind of aggressive and kind of wants it not to be about him, but he makes it about him and stuff. I don't know.
I think he does want it to be about him. Yeah. I think there's something. It's almost like, I don't know how to say this. There's a power in knowledge, right? And if you're at the center of the establishment and you hold secrets, there's something that can make you quite arrogant about that you're in this privileged inner circle. And I think the same kind of goes for some of the investigative journalists who work on that they're almost glamoured by it. Like, they like to also be seen to be in that inner circle. So it's almost as if he's boasting about it to Errol Morris and to Erik Olsen. Yeah. Like, hey, I know I'm in this privileged little circle, but because of my whole thing with my source, I can't tell you because you're mere plebs, but I know. I'm a holder of valuable information.
But that's
the way it came across to me.
That's anyone with any status or reputation where they're held up as like a Pulitzer winning, you know, journalist who takes journalism really seriously and will teach you like about, you know, holding sources and like, you know, you should go to jail because instead of giving up who your, you know, source was or whatever and get on their high horse and like feel like all high and mighty. And at the end of the day, it's like, dude, come on. Like, there's information that you're sitting on.
I mean, I agree, protect your source. I mean, my goodness, that's the first. I 100% agree with that. But I just think it's the way in which he says it, which felt a little bit sneering or contemptuous. And I'm probably overreading into that.
But... No, doesn't he say, like, I'm operating a level above you, basically?
I mean, unbelievably condescending.
Yeah. And I think that one of the good things about the documentary, it's kind of the nature of knowledge and the truth. And what is it for? And is the truth even a good thing at some point? You know, I think it raises interesting questions, but, you know, I'm not sure what the answers are.
I think that's what, like, Erik Olsen is wrestling with throughout the entire thing is, like, what does he do if he does find the truth? Like, does that make it all better or...
Exactly. But I think maybe it's something about having sort of waded through this 6 hours of TV. You get to the end and the final episode really is. It's the tragedy of Erik Olsen. It's not really about the dad anymore. And you have this very emotionally affecting picture of a broken man. Very, of course, superficially successful and he has a family. But ultimately, at his core, very frustrated. And then you have Seymour Hersh, who has the capability of had the capability in 1975 probably of revealing what had happened and didn't and is crowing about this secret knowledge. And I just found Errol Morris's cutting of those two together at the end very provocative.
I agree. It's really powerful at the end and kind of unsatisfying on a lot of levels.
Absolutely. And it's wormwood for us too, right? We're frustrated. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, it's an interesting
knowledge
documentary.
Better, right?
Yeah, it puts you in, I mean, this tiny little insight that you have in what it is to be Erik Olsen because you face that same frustration. And we're also left feeling, well, even if we knew, would that make it better? This guy still was killed by his own country's government. His wife still had a blighted life. You know, what good does this do us? Maybe this brings us to a nice segue to talk about the way in which the series was made. I think we've talked a lot about the mixed media format and the sort of the use of the fictionalized stuff and the pacing, I guess. we've talked about too. But overall, what did you like? Like, we've talked about what we didn't like a lot, I think.
Yeah, for me, I just didn't like the pacing and length. It felt indulgent and unnecessary. And I think, you know, Bina said this could be a 2 hour, 2.5 hour, and it certainly could, and get the whole thing. And certainly, I feel like 4 hours is plenty of time to get the full arc that Morris is taking us on here. I think it's well done. I think the performances are good. The production value, sets, everything, you know, costumes, it's really well done. I just don't think it needs to be 6 episodes. And maybe that's a Netflix thing. I don't know.
It has to be, right? Because, I mean, 6 episodes sounds like just the right amount, because I think they're not a full hour. Aren't they like 45 minutes each?
I think they vary, but yeah, I think they're around 50 minutes or something each.
But I think that's like Netflix's formula now, is to have that 6 episode, first two set up, you know, have the arc, you know, the two, two, and two, like first, second, and third act. And I think that I agree that, although I did like the dramatization for the entertainment value, I don't know how much truth was in there. I think that just the interview with Eric Olson and like some of the other people would have made this a very compelling 2-3 episode series.
Yeah, I agree. Is there anything else you want to talk about with respect to the TV show? I mean, I think we've done it quite thoroughly.
No, I think it's worth watching if you have.
Oh, for sure. If you're interested in this kind of shit,
it's interesting. Yeah, and you should be interested in this kind of shit. Honestly, if you're not, you should be.
Yeah. Well, especially when this is part of the, you know, sicko serial killer ones, but it's government abuses, man.
Everything links to everything else. So the Rockefeller Commission also had studies within it linked to the JFK assassination, which we're covering, and the head snap in the Zapruder film. you know, the presence potentially of E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis in Dallas. I mean, this era is just everything links to everything.
Yeah, it goes back to the CIA, right?
Yeah.
Everything. Yeah. Watergate, Kennedy assassination,
yep.
MK Ultra. It's not a coincidence, in my opinion.
And poor Frank Olson, a scientist, yeah. Who's got swept up in it all.
Yeah, it's all because, you know, American greatness and, you know, beating the commies.
Yeah, I would say... Just one thing I took away from this is if your parents are still alive, you should definitely have conversations with them about stuff.
Right. Well, I guess then we can wrap up a short and concise, unusually concise episode for VOK. Thank you very much for joining. I want to thank Jock, Thomas, and Matt, and hope you've enjoyed listening, and that if you watch Wormwood and are interested in all sorts of other shenanigans that usually have the CIA at their core, that you stay tuned for other psycho serial killer episodes of Vok, which do things that aren't really about serial killers, but we cast on
so,
it.
So, oh, fuck, I forgot to bring up the fact that, what do you think of the name Wormwood?
I think it's beautiful, and I think the more you think it's about Eric Olson, and in a sense, the more you think about it, it's people like us who try and get to the bottom of riddles and conspiracies that we'll never truly know the answer to.
No, you dummy. Wormwood is a hallucinogenic property in absinthe. It's a...
I think it has many meanings here, or multiple meanings at least.
But the meaning that Eric Olson evidently gives it, because he says it in the final episode, is the biblical one, that it's bitter. It's just knowledge is bitter.
Yeah.
And frustrating. Yeah. But I love the title.
Yeah, I did too. Does this change your feelings about JFK or any of that stuff at all, Bina? Or is this completely irrelevant to that for you?
No, it does. And I tell you why it does. It's sort of a conflation of watching this and watching... the post recently, which kind of got me back into that Watergate mood, and just realizing how infinitely corrupt that particular period was.
Yeah, even with season 2 of The Crown on the British side, like I'd be interested to learn like some of Britain's like dirty little secrets like this.
Well, if you and Greg will give me a time for a vollop, maybe you would.
Yeah, right now, Greg was ready to go on this.
Boom. Okay, guys. Well, thank you very much for joining, and goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.